by Daniel.
All right, thank you very much. As the last talk today, I'll try to keep things light. In particular, I've tried to make the presentation as elementary as possible. This is joint work with Nate Ackerman and Cameron in the front, and we're going to be talking about non-computable conditional distributions. So to start things off, I'm going to briefly give some context for this work by describing our motivations for studying the computability of conditional probability. And that motivation is the application of probabilistic programming within statistics and AI. So normally, if you want to specify a distribution, say a discrete distribution, for every, say you have a large number of random variables, for every possible configuration of those random variables, you have to give a probability. Much more compact way of describing a distribution is by giving a, essentially by giving a random variable. Or in the probabilistic programming approach within AI, you describe a joint distribution for some probabilistic model by giving a randomized algorithm that generates a sample. And you guys are all very familiar with probabilistic programming languages. So this is really sort of, I kind of view the probabilistic programming approach, you know, the rediscovery of all these ideas within AI, the kind of rediscovering all this work in this area. But I view this approach as sort of the end game of this problem of how do we compactly represent very complex models. And within AI and statistics, models are getting very complicated, and essentially people are reinventing programming languages because they have to manage that complexity. So it's way back. So this is a kind of classical statistical notation. You have random variables here on the left. You're defining, this is defining an array of random variables that depend on other random variables. And you can kind of think of this as a very simple program. And a revolution in AI came in the late 80s, early 90s with the identification that, or with the realization that the conditional independence structure, so what depends on what, which can be represented usually by a compact graph, that this is the leverage you need for implementing efficient algorithms. Now the problem is that this is a pretty simple graph, and people are building much more complex ones, and they're doing things like programming languages. They're recognizing, I really want to be treating this as a primitive, and I want to define means of combination. Or they essentially need recursion, but they don't have any way of representing this in their very simple formalisms. So it's not uncommon to actually see pseudocode in these papers. And people, they don't really blink an eye when they think about when someone defines a distribution by possibly recursive. So here's a defining a distribution, it's kind of like a procedure MP, and it calls itself, it recurses, it's building a random tree. So this is a way of defining a reasonably complex distribution on random trees, or defining a random tree, which of course has some distribution. So all right, so leaping forward, people are using. So this is an example of a kind of language I'm involved in, which is essentially a probabilistic scheme. And this is very natural for doing things that were quite complicated in the graphical model setting, like, for example, putting distributions on distributions. So higher order languages are very useful in this setting. So this doesn't look very AI-ish. These are lumps. This is more AI-ish. I'm not going to go into any detail here, but for example, if you want to model communication between two rational agents, you really need to have the speaker thinking about the listener and the listener thinking about the speaker, and that's naturally modeled by mutually recursive procedures and kind of thinking about each other. Here, the randomness enters here with this binary operator here, which is kind of similar to this, and here's some expression which is kind of a random variable for my beliefs about what sentences I might say given my state, et cetera. I'm not going to go into detail, but this kind of motivates why people might be interested in probabilistic programming languages, because they're building very complicated things. So this gives theoreticians lots of interesting questions to think about. So the question that I'm going to talk about today is one of probabilistic inference in the setting. So just briefly, just jumping back, the normal setting is, so this is defining the model sort of in a forward direction. I sample theta, I sample xi, etas, and then given all these, I can sample any particular entry. Or once I get the row and the column representation, I can sample the element at ij. Now, normally the setting of inference is I get to observe, say, maybe this is a social network, and I get to observe who's friends with who, and maybe some edges are missing I'm trying to predict. But then I'm trying to do inference on representations of, say, people in the social network, or trying to make some inference here. So really the problem is going backwards, which is kind of, you know, should be natural if you think about probabilistic inference as sort of a generalization of logic, logical inference. All right, so the problem, slightly more carefully, the problem is someone gives you a probabilistic program, and the problem of the algorithm designer for people trying to use probabilistic programs in AI is that someone gives you a representation for a joint distribution. This is your model. You can think of X here as representing your data, and the hypothesis here is representing some quantity that you don't get to observe, but you want to learn about by observing the data. And then you get some actual observation from the world, and your job is to either sample from this conditional distribution or produce some representation of it. So the number of existing algorithms that implement this idea to varying levels of generality, a common gap is that the support for the case when X here is continuous and you're making some particular observations rather ad hoc. And so our work was essentially to explain why this support is necessarily ad hoc, to answer critics why you can't do anything better than ad hoc. And we're also going to get some positive results. Jump ahead, it's not going to be possible to do this when this in general when this is continuous, but we're going to carve out some positive results as well when in fact you can implement this and solve this problem. So conditional probability is fundamental to statistics. It's essentially the way that you interpret data. It's also, of course, fundamental to probability theory itself. Now, Kolmogorov in the 30s gave a modern definition, but it was given by an integral equation that essentially defines conditional probability in an implicit way. So that kicked off a long search and study for search for more constructive approaches. And there's a large body of work searching for more constructive definitions of conditional probability. We're going to take here computational perspective. We're going to ask, when can we compute conditional probabilities in the probabilistic programming setting, in the setting I just described. So you have a joint distribution described by a probabilistic program, and I'll kind of give a more precise definition by what I'm talking about here in a minute. And then you get some data, and then your job is to produce some representation for the conditional distribution. And what we're going to show is, in general, these conditional probabilities are not computable, but we're going to highlight some additional structure where you can actually condition. And more specifically, we're going to produce a pair of random variables that are computable. And there's going to be such that classically there's a version of this conditional distribution that is continuous on measure one set. So this classically is a very nice object, but no version is computable. And moreover, if you have an oracle which computes this conditional distribution, then that oracle can compute the Halting problem. All right, so the basic formalism the way we're going to prove this result is we're going to adopt a very simple formalism, and that is of probabilistic programs are, we're going to take them to be Turing machines with random bit tape, and we're going to take, and computable distributions in the setting are going to be the distributions of the output of these probabilistic programs suitably interpreted. So, Turing machines spitting out some bits, we might interpret those bits representing integers, or infinite strings of bits might represent real numbers. Now, the approach we're taking here, I'm not going to go, so rather than pause here and give a large number of definitions, I'm just going to rely mostly on your intuition, because I think it'll be right. However, if you're curious where this sits, essentially this essential approach lines up with that of type 2 theory of effectivity, which itself builds on older work, computability at higher types. Of course, this mirrors and lines up quite nicely with work in effective domain theory and semantics, at least in the simplistic setting that we're going to be working at. But again, I'm going to just keep things light. I'm going to rely upon intuition, and when I need to define something, I'm going to define it just in time. Okay. All right. So here's some warm up. So assume that we can sample a pair of random variables from some distribution, and then we assume also that this variable here is discrete. So the problem is, okay, how do we given a particular value for x sample from P of y given x? All right. So this is the simplest possible. This is a simple setting, and here's a simple answer. Essentially, what you do is you can repeatedly sample from this joint distribution, and you wait until the sample value of x takes the value that you're trying to condition on, and then you stop, and then you return the associated pair y. And you can show it's not too difficult that this in fact will be a sample from this conditional distribution. All right. Now, there's one subtlety here, which is that it better be the case that this event happens with some probability, strictly greater than zero, because otherwise this won't hold. So in fact, that points out that in the setting we care about, these are going to be randomized Turing machines that halt almost surely. Or if they're spitting out an infinite sequence of bits, they will never halt with probability one. Okay. So the first observation here is that of course this is not going to solve the problem in the continuous case, and that's because if x is a continuous random variable, then this condition fails. Particular x takes any particular value with measures probability zero, and so this will loop forever. Okay, so you need something more subtle. Now, if you played around with probability theory or derived any conditional distributions, you've probably worked with Bayes' rule, and that's the way for taking a density function, a joint density function, and driving a conditional density function. Now, one thing I just like to highlight is that a probabilistic program is not handing you the density function over the random variables that it samples. So here, just to kind of mention what I'm talking about, here's, say, the density function of a pair of Gaussian random variables. If I want to condition on, say, a particular value, so I say, I observe that this variable here takes some value around here, then what you're really doing is looking at this slice, and that induces some distribution on the remaining. In this case, there's two random variables, so it induces some distribution on the other random variable. Now, if you give me a probabilistic program, if you give me a Turing machine that outputs these bits, then I can compute its distribution function. But I'm not necessarily, if what it's spitting out is representations of real numbers, I can't in general determine the PDF. Now, of course, classically, it may not even have a PDF, right? So that's just something to keep in mind here. And what we're going to see is conditioning. So certainly we're not in the setting, the very simple setting, discrete random variables. We're also not in the kind of classical, your high school or first year probability course. This is a slightly more abstract setting. So here's a further wrench. So I'm going to describe a simple setting, distribution. There are going to be several random variables, but in the end, we're going to have a joint distribution over two random variables where things can't possibly be computable. So let's start by fixing some enumeration of rationals in the unit interval. All right, and I'm going to have three very simple random variables, so manifestly computable. So start with random variable C. So this is just a fair coin flip. Then we have a random variable N, which is going to be a random integer with a geometric distribution. So this is essentially the number of flips number of flips you need to do before a head comes up, given that the coin is biased to come up 0.9, okay, 90% of the time. And U here is going to be continuous distribution uniform on the unit interval. Okay, so now I'm going to define this derived random variable, also manifestly computable from these, which is if this coin comes up one heads, if you will, then x is going to take the value of the uniform random variable. If it comes up zero, it's going to take the value of the nth. So here's a random variable. It's going to take the value of the nth rational. Okay. So just in pictures, so here's a cumulative distribution function. I'm just going to say distribution function from now on. So here's the distribution function of u, straight line, uniform distribution. This is the probability that u is less than any particular value. So it's 1 over here because it's entirely contained in the unit interval. Here is an approximate depiction of this random variable, a random rational. Okay, so it has jumps everywhere. And this is the mixture of these two, because that's what we're doing here. We're essentially mixing these two things. Now let's study this particular conditional distribution. What is the conditional probability that that coin, which I don't get to observe, so I observe x, observe a random quantity between 0 and 1, continuous. What's the probability that it was generated from a heads or generated from a tails? So this is, what is the probability it was generated from a tails? Okay? So here's some elementary calculations. So first of all, if x is irrational, we know it couldn't have been generated from here. So we know c was 1. So this, the probability c is 0, 0. Now note that u is continuous, so take any particular value with measure zero. And so if X is rational, then almost surely it was generated in this case. Okay? So just copying this back up. This is our function. That's a pretty nasty function. Now, so in what sense could this be computable? And it's going to certainly depend on how we represent our input here. We have a floating point number. All floating point numbers are rationals, and so that's kind of trivial and absurd at the same time. And if I keep getting more and more accuracy here, then at no point am I going to be able to decide whether X is rational. And this is just disconcerting to, say, people in like statistics and AI who think that floating point is fine for everything. Now I'm defining these distributions, and all of a sudden I'm having to pay attention to representation. So, you know, ultimately what's going on here is this function here, f, is discontinuous everywhere, which is a fundamental barrier to this thing being computable. Okay, so the point is we're going to have to pay attention to representation. In particular, if we're going to have continuous real quantities, we're going to have to be very careful how we represent them. And you might ask, so is this about a density existing? Because here we have mixed discrete continuous. It's not really, it's really orthogonal to whether a density exists. You can cause trouble whether or not you classically have a density or not. Right. So what we're going to demonstrate to kind of what you might ask is, okay, well, we have this situation where classically the conditional distribution is this discontinuous everywhere function. So what we're going to do is we're going to shrink our view, and we're going to say, okay, let's restrict ourselves to situations where classically we're guaranteed a continuous version of the conditional. So we're going to throw away the situations where we're going to run into this roadblock we just ran into. Okay, we're going to restrict our setting to where we're guaranteed a continuous version of the conditional distribution. Okay, but in fact, we're going to run into another. And we're going to demonstrate a negative result here, too. So we're going to demonstrate a computable, absolutely continuous. That means it has a density with respect to the Lebesgue measure. A computable, absolutely continuous distribution on the unit square, so it's a pair of random variables taking values in the unit interval, whose condition this distribution is not computable. Yet, for example, the density exists. Or you can easily tweak it so the density doesn't exist. Again, it's orthogonal. All right, so it's just so everyone in this room familiar with this, so this is kind of the first thing I need to make clear. So here we're gonna pick a representation for real numbers. So this is not really a representation, but so just recall that so if some real number in the unit interval is computable, if and only if its binary bit sequence is computable. And luckily for me, you saw this figure in the last talk. So we're gonna talk about random. Thank you. We're gonna talk about random reals. As ones where you are sampling a path down here in precisely the same sense as the last talk. Okay, so what we're going to define here is something we'll call the halting distribution. Okay, so for every natural number m, we're going to define one of these halting distributions. And it's going to work in the following way. All right, and we're going to use this in order to build this distribution. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to start off running this mth Turing machine, and each time we're going to look and ask whether the machine is halted. If it halts at precisely time t, then when we're at that level of the tree, we're going to, rather than, let me explain this backwards. For all times where it hasn't just halted, or it's halted a long time ago, we're going to go left and right with equal probability. But on precisely the stage where the machine that you're watching halts, we're going to flip a bias coin. We're going to go to the, I suppose, right, with probability 2/3, and to the left with probability 1/3. Because so normally you're falling down this tree, going left and right with equal probability. But if we're talking about halting distribution for some particular m, on the nth, if that machine halts on time at step k, then at the kth level it's going to go less often than it goes right. Okay. So here's the halting distribution. So we're going to start with the uniform sample from y. So y is a uniform random variable. We're going to turn this into a random integer. Okay, this is a geometric random variable. And what we're going to do is we're going to then sample x, condition on n, that just means it depends on n. We're going to sample x according to the halting time distribution, where the Turing machine is this random Turing machine that we've gotten by turning y into an integer. Okay. Now, what is this conditional distribution? Now, note this thing is continuous. Now, it has these stripings, but you can get rid of that striping. So you can kind of ignore that. All right. So this is the punchline. This distribution is not computable. And essentially, the reason why it isn't is that you could compute this one, which is very related to this one. If you could compute this, then this very elementary ratio here would fall into these two categories. If this n1, which you get to choose and is arbitrary, if this n1 it corresponds to the Turing machine which halts, then this quantity falls into this set, and otherwise it falls into this, and it's very easy to. This is a real quantity. You're computing this. Eventually, you can decide this, then you're done. Now, of course, we're talking about this operation of conditioning. We've just demonstrated that a computable object, because this thing is highly computable. I can easily sample uniformly here. I can easily take a log. I can. Now, you might be worried about discontinuities here, but you fall in that discontinuity with measure zero. So we're talking about these in this setting, random variables are ones where it halts almost surely, so that's fine. You can, in this mechanism I described to you, falling down this Cantor tree is highly computable. So this is a computable pair of random variables. But conditioning necessarily maps it to a non-computable object because I can do this. Ergo, conditioning is not computable. So I guess the punchline is, in the probabilistic programming world, we're not closed under conditioning when you have continuous random variables lying around. Now, of course, humans have been manipulating these objects, and they never run into this problem. So what's the gap? Why in practice are we always able to derive these things for things we care about? So this is really a study of some additional structure. So here's a simple case. So let's study this conditional distribution. So here we're conditioning it not just on x, but we're conditioning on x plus this xi. So here this is distributed uniformly in an arbitrarily small ball. Okay. Now of course you can rewrite this as x falling in an epsilon ball around x. And of course that's just a conditional. That's just a discrete random variable. So now we're back to the trivial setting that we described with the rejection sampling. So that's computable by the rejection sampling argument we made earlier. And that whole argument can be generalized in this way, which is that if you have a pair of random variables in the same setting, and you have some noise random variable, which is absolutely continuous and independent of x and y, then if I corrupt the observation with this absolutely continuous independent noise, now this conditional distribution is going to be uniformly computable in all the relevant variables. So this does cover a surprising number of kind of cases in practice where you believe that there's some noise process at the end of your probabilistic model. Of course, a corollary of this is that because this is computable and the previous setting is not, we can't, in general, give you an algorithm which tells you how to relax your condition in order to make it computable. If you add some noise, then in general, you're not going to be able to figure out how different your answer is. All right, so this is one other. I have no idea how I'm doing on time. Great, perfect. All right, so this is another setting where additional structure can help you out. So this is a very classical setting. If you study some frequentist statistics, this would be the setting. Given IID data xi from an unknown distribution nu, estimate nu, right? So you have some. You have some population and heights, and you can pick people at random. You see their heights, and you're trying to figure out what's the distribution of heights. That'd be like the setting. So in the Bayesian framework, this translates into you have an exchangeable sequence of observations x1, x2, and a very deep theorem known as DeFinetti's theorem in probability theory says that these random variables can be represented in this particular way. There is some random, so rather than the unknown, there's a random probability measure with some distribution, and the xi's are drawn IID, conditionally IID from nu. Now, this classical frequentist problem corresponds to this Bayesian one. What is the conditional distribution of this random measure given these observations? So in general, this is not computable. You can easily construct situations where this not. Now it happens to be the case in practice that this distribution on an exchangeable sequence of random variables is usually given to you by another type of conditional distribution called a predictive rule, which is that if I give you the first k elements for some k, then you can tell me the distribution on the next one. And you can use a computable version of the DeFinelli's theorem to show that when this collection of predictive rules, when this predictive rule is computable, then you have this posterior, this conditional distribution is computable. So that's another way in which structure can enter in and make these things computable. All right, so to wrap up. We're looking at probabilistic programming in AI and asking when can we perform important really the most important operation, which is forming the conditional distribution. So the main fact here, the one that's most disheartening to people in my field, is that probabilistic programmings are not closed-ended conditioning. However, you add some additional structure, like you add some noise to the observation, now you're good to go. And some other types of structure, like exchangeability, can enable conditioning. Our hope is that these observations can influence the design of probabilistic programming languages. For example, if you're working in the setting of predictive rules, and you can just provide a way for the language to define predictive rules, and that therefore you can guarantee that it's possible, at the very least, to compute these posterior distributions. These also are a new perspective on this large body of work on the foundations of conditional and probability, in particular search for constructive definitions. I think there's more to say here, though we haven't done that yet. And finally, this is part of a larger program that Cameron and I and Nate are working on to kind of build a better understanding of computational limits of doing Bayesian reasoning in this probabilistic programming setting. Thank you.